Good morning.
Good morning.
All right, we're here. Good deal. A couple of things before we start. Just wanted to update you. You know that we have a team of folks who went to Africa as part of the Amaharo trip and got a text message from Tim. He was like, I found an African SIM card, and so text me if you need anything. But things are well. They are in Rwanda right now, and I'm finishing up the conference around reconciliation in Rwanda, and then they will be making the journey to Pakat. And as I can tell, as they can tell, we're still, the well digging is happening, so they'll get to see some of that, and hopefully we'll come back with good video footage of that. So keep praying for that team. And then just the other thing, Julie mentioned the team going to Croc, Mexico. Just as much as you can look at that list of needs and help out, it would be great. One thing I want to point out is, as you know, gas is going up, and so that's affecting our trip as well. We're going to go. We will be in Croc one way or the other, but if anybody feels so led, we'd love to be able to help the team out by sending them with some money to get down there on gas as well. So if you'll remember those two things, that would be great. As Julie also mentioned, we're in the midst of a sermon series called Neglected Women of the Faith, and the organizing text around that is Matthew 1, she said, and it's really looking at the four Old Testament women that Matthew lists in the genealogy of Jesus. So we've covered Tamar, and we've covered Rahab, and so today what we're going to do is cover a look at Ruth. And I don't know about you, but you know, Tamar is a challenge given kind of the circumstances that surround her. And even Rahab, if you look at Rahab and think about kind of Rahab's life, less of a challenge than Tamar maybe, but still kind of a challenge to us. I think Ruth might be a little more palatable for those of us who kind of live in this day and age, but yet I still think she's calling us to some profound things, and so we're going to look at what that means. The one thing I want to say before that is it strikes me, you know, when I was reading through Ruth's story, what I was struck by is, in some ways, I really resonate with Ruth, and here's how I resonate. So the story opens up by saying, okay, they were in this land here, Ruth, or Naomi, it starts with a guy named Elimelech. Let me look, I've just forgotten his name. Have you all, Elimelech, okay, thank you. I look at him, and the story starts out, he's living in this land, he's married to this woman named Naomi, and what he decides to do is he picks his stuff up. He decides, you know what, not the place for me, there was a famine in the land, and he decides that he's going to move his family, which at the time was his wife Naomi and his two sons, and they're going to move to a place called Moab. Now, the interesting thing about that, this is significant. This isn't just someone, I mean, as significant it is as it may be to move from, say, Kansas City to L.A. or Kansas City to New York or wherever it is, this is even more significant because what you're doing is you understand that folks live kind of in these tribal clan kinds of things. And so when you live in this kind of tribal setting, everybody in your little town or village is related to you. People on the outskirts of your town and village are related to you. And if you move away from that, you are essentially disconnecting yourself from the community that is supporting you. So that's the first thing. The second thing is when he decides to move, he decides to move to Moab. That's not a place that worships Yahweh. So not only is he disconnecting himself from the entire community, but what he's doing is he's going to this place which is completely isolated, which has a completely set of different customs. The language is probably the same, but this isn't a place that worships Yahweh. So two really kind of significant things. And the reason why that resonates with me is I just remember growing up, my family was pretty nomadic. And so we moved around quite a bit. And I remember my dad would just get restless. So we'd be in a place. We lived in Lexington, Kentucky for 4 years. And he'd be like, I'm kind of getting bored at work. I don't know that he said all these things, but assuming. I'm kind of getting bored at work, ready for new challenges. So he'd decide, I want to move. So he would kind of put out his resume or whatever he did at the time. And he'd find a new place to live. He would go up to that place, and it would be up to my mom to kind of get the house sold, to get my brother and I all packed, get the house all packed up, and move out there. And then we'd move from Lexington to Brookfield, Connecticut. And 2 years later, he's like, I want to do something else. We move down to Fort Worth. He comes down in advance. My mom wraps up. And so as this story unfolds, it strikes me that Naomi kind of is in this similar situation. Is Here the head of the household says, we're moving, and it's up to her to kind of figure out what happens. But then you have an even more strange thing that happens, or a surprise, at least in my case. You know, what happens is Elimelech decides, well, he doesn't decide, but he dies, right? So not only now is Naomi in this place, but she's in this place with her two sons, and she's isolated from family and all of that. She's trying to make her way, and so they decide that the two sons end up getting married, and they marry two Moabite women. Well, as we have seen in previous stories, the two sons die. So now it's Naomi, and it's her daughter-in-law, Orpah, and it's her daughter-in-law, Ruth, right? These three folks. So get the picture here. She's in this strange land. She has no family. She's cut off. She's in a place that doesn't worship the God that she worships, and now she has to make her way with her two daughter-in-laws. Or conversely, if you want to look at it through the eyes of the daughter-in-laws, they have to live with their mother-in-law. For some of you, that's more traumatic than others. But this is where we're going to jump into the text now, because essentially what happens is, what's going to happen? And that's chapter one is what I've given you, and in the beginning of chapter two, we're going to kind of see how Ruth engages with that. And some of this might be familiar to some of you. So let's put up the first passage. This is Ruth. It's Ruth 1. We're going to pick it up in verse 8. Okay? Ruth 1, starting at verse 8. Then Naomi said to her two daughters-in-law, go back, each of you, to your mother's home. May the Lord show you kindness as you have shown kindness to your dead and to me. May the Lord grant that each of you will find rest in the home of another husband. Then she kissed them goodbye, and they wept aloud and said to her, we will go back with you to your people. But Naomi said, return home, my daughters. Why would you come with me? Am I going to have any more sons who could become your husbands? Return home, my daughters. I am too old to have another husband. Even if I thought there was still hope for me, even if I had a husband tonight and then gave birth to sons, would you wait until they grew up? Would you remain unmarried for them? No, my daughters. It is more bitter for me than for you, because the Lord's hand has turned against me. At this, they wept aloud again. Then Orpah kissed her mother-in-law goodbye, but Ruth clung to her. Look, said Naomi, your sister-in-law is going back to her people and her gods. Go back with her. But Ruth replied, don't urge me to leave you or to turn back from you. Where you go, I will go. And where you stay, I will stay. Your people will be my people and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die. And there I will be buried. May the Lord deal with me, be it ever so severely, if even death separates you and me. When Naomi realized that Ruth was determined to go with her, she stopped urging her. So the two women went on until they came to Bethlehem. When they arrived in Bethlehem, the whole town was stirred because of them, and the women exclaimed, can this be Naomi? Don't call me Naomi, she told them. Call me Mara, because the Almighty has made my life very bitter. I went away full, but the Lord has brought me back empty. Why call me Naomi? The Lord has afflicted me. The Almighty has brought misfortune upon me. We'll come back to that, actually. We're going to pause there. Let's get some reactions, reflections. What strikes you about this passage as you hear kind of Naomi engaging with her daughters-in-law, Orpah, and then Ruth, and then as Ruth kind of engages back with her? Anything strike you? Yeah, Jill.
She's already alone, but yet because she's lost her husband and her son, but she's making herself even more alone by pushing her daughters along.
Okay, so there's a sense in which she's isolated, and her daughters-in-law, they don't want her to stay isolated, but she for whatever reason, wants to continue that. And she talks a little bit about kind of God's hand going against her and that sense of bitterness, right? Anything else strike you about this passage? Yeah. Yeah, so the comment is that there's just a lot of love there. There's this sense in which there's a strong connection between mother-daughter, between daughter-mother. I mean, there is this very strong connection, absolutely. Anything else strike you? Yeah. So why was Orpah willing to leave? You know, so the first comment, or the first time around, she's like, no, no, I'll stay. And it could be that she's like, well, if Ruth is staying, I guess I have to stay. But once, right, once Naomi says, no, go back. There's nothing for you here. I'm not going to get married again. There's no future for you. Okay, see you, bye. Maybe, maybe. But, I mean, she was released to go, but Ruth felt something different. Sure. Couple, yeah, Larry. Okay, so yeah, there is a sense in which Naomi does feel like that God is standing against her, and then but Ruth wanted to at least offer herself up as kind of a different interpretation of that. Really interesting, and connected into this, you all understand some of what we've already covered around Levirate law, right? I mean, that's why Naomi was so willing to kind of urge her daughters away, because what she was saying, what we heard about Levirate law later, is, you know, so if the husband dies, then it's the brother that's supposed to marry, and then if that person dies, like we saw in Tamar, it's the next brother. What's going on here is she's like, there is no sense in which you all, if you stay with me, will be married again. I mean, and she says it pretty specifically. Look, even if I marry today, and then I had a kid, are you going to wait around for that person so that you could marry him? What Naomi was saying to her daughters-in-law, very clearly, there is no future if you stay with me. There's nothing for you, only death and misery. And who's going to take care of us? And it's in the midst of that you hear Ruth's response. And I think that response, does that response sound pretty familiar to you? Have you heard that response? Where you go, I will go. Where you stay, I will stay. It's the response that we take and we put sometimes then in the context of a marriage ceremony. We've interpreted Ruth's loving response to her mother-in-law and we've put it in the context of marriage. And I just wonder if that response, I want to read it again to you. Ben, can we put that back up? But Ruth replied, don't urge me to leave you or to turn back from you. Where you go, I will go. And where you stay, I will stay. Your people will be my people and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die. And there I will be buried. May the Lord deal with me, be it ever so severely, if even death separates you and me. What an amazing commitment. And you all might laugh at this, but to her mother-in-law, no less, this isn't family. This is family by marriage. Whatever happens to you, it's going to happen to me also. And this is a response that a lot of us hear, and this is an amazing response, but I think there's even more that's connected here. The Hebrew word for kind of this response, how Ruth responds, is the word chesed. It's sometimes interpreted as loving kindness. That what Ruth is doing is out of her depth, she's offering loving kindness back to her mother-in-law. Whatever happens to you will happen to me. And I think Ruth understands very clearly that what she's getting into is nothing that's going to be fulfilling. She's going, Ruth now, when Naomi decides she's going to go back to Bethlehem, back to her people, that means Ruth now is estranged from her family and her people. And she's saying, I'm going to leave everything that I know. Even though you've given me the release, I'm going to leave everything that I know to go be in this different place, because what happens to you, I'm willing to allow it to happen to me as well. And I think sometimes when we take that chesed response that Ruth gives and we put it in the context of marriage, what we do is we, in some ways, we then allow it to talk just about kind of this kind of husband and wife love. And I think what this text is saying to us, and I think what Ruth is saying to us, is fundamental in relationships is this notion of chesed, this notion of loving kindness, this notion of connection that's even more fundamental than when a man loves a woman. It's actually about what it means to be connected and committed to each other in community. And when we interpret this simply within the bounds of marriage, I think what we do is we miss the notion that what God is calling us to do is to be connected with each other in community, to be willing to say, where you go, I will go with you. Where you stay, I will stay. We're going to put down roots together, or we're going to pick up together. What happens to you happens to me. This isn't just about a marriage relationship. This is about a fundamental commitment in community with each other. I'm willing to take this journey with you even though I don't know what the future holds. That's amazing. That's even more life-giving. Even within the confines of marriage, it's saying that for me, when I say that to my wife, I have that kind of hesed relationship. It's not just about what we are as husband and wife, but it's even more, it's something different than that. It's that I'm committing to you as a person of God that says we will be together, but not just as man and wife, but really as this thing that God says God is calling me to do that is demonstrated in Ruth. Connection and commitment in community. And part of what I love about this is it leaves room for those of us who may not have found a mate to be with. Because even in that context, for those of us that are single, we're still called to have this kind of chesed relationship. We're still called to community. We're still called to commit. And then for those of us who are in a marriage relationship, we're still called to commit, not just to our mate, but to other people in the community. What an amazing truth. What an amazing sense of commitment. And so part of the first part, what's amazing to me is there is this notion of this chesed relationship, this loving kindness, this call to commitment, but it's not there. What Ruth says is amazing, but then what she does in some ways is even more amazing. Let's look at chapter 2 now. Infant 380. That's the chesed relationship, the father going to be with. All right, let's look at chapter 2. We're going to look at 2 verses 1 through 12. Now Naomi had a relative on her husband's side, a man of standing from the clan of Elimelech, whose name was Boaz. And Ruth the Moabite said to Naomi, "Let me go to the fields and pick up the leftover grain behind anyone whose eyes I find favor." Naomi said to her, "Go ahead, my daughter." So she went out and entered a field and began to glean behind the harvesters. As it turned out, she found herself working in a field belonging to Boaz, who was from the clan of Elimelech. Just then, Boaz arrived from Bethlehem and greeted the harvesters. "The Lord be with you." "The Lord bless you," they answered. Boaz asked the overseer of his harvesters, "Who does that young woman belong to?" The overseer replied, "She is the Moabite who came back from Moab with Naomi. She said, 'Please let me glean and gather among the sheaves behind the harvesters.' She came into the field and has remained here from morning till now, except for a short rest in the shelter." So Boaz said to Ruth, "My daughter, listen to me. Don't go and glean in another field and don't go away from here. Stay here with the women who work for me. Watch the field where the harvesters are working and follow along after the women. I have told the men not to lay a hand on you, and whenever you are thirsty, go and get a drink from the water jars the men have filled." At this, she bowed down with her face to the ground. She asked him, "Why have I found such favor in your eyes that you notice me, a foreigner?" Boaz replied, "I've been told all about what you have done for your mother-in-law since the death of your husband, how you left your father and mother and your homeland and came to live with a people you did not know before. May the Lord repay you for what you have done. May you be richly rewarded by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge." So you understand here that what's happened is Naomi and Ruth have gone back to Bethlehem, and she's now made this amazing sense of commitment. "I'm going to be with you." But that's not all. I mean, the story doesn't end there, because what happens is, how are they going to live? Still, two single women, and they've committed to each other, and that's amazing, and that's all and good, but how will they be provided for? And so finally, Ruth decides, or she says to herself, "Hey, it's up to me. The sense that we get here is that Naomi is probably too old to go into the fields and harvest, so it's up to her to kind of provide. So she goes out to the fields. Now, before I try and explain this, let me just say up to you, in all fairness, number one, I'm a kid that grew up in the suburbs, right? And then I've kind of made this sense of commitment to the city. So this whole harvesting kind of thing, I'm going to try and explain it, but I'm going to tell you up front, I have no idea what I'm talking about. But I read it over and over again to try to give myself a sense of at least explain to you what happens. So I kind of get it, but there is, I'm out of my wheelhouse here. So just want to admit that up front. But as I understand it, here's kind of how they harvested the fields. Stuff was planted in rows, kind of like you all are sitting in rows right now. Stuff is planted in rows. And what the harvesters would do is, in one hand, they would grab whatever they were trying to get, right? They would grab it. The other hand, they had a sickle, and then they would start to chop at it. And then, once they got it, they'd have a handful, and then they'd go and grab another handful and chop at it. And once their hands were full, right, then what they would do would be to drop it, and they'd kind of go down the row, and when they were done with that row, they would come back and bundle it all up, and those would be called sheaves, right? So you would have sheaves at the end of rows. Now, here's Jewish law. Here's what Jewish law said or held out for these folks. That you can imagine if you're chopping, you grab a handful, you're chopping, even if you have big hands, even if you're really good at this, that as you go to grab another set of stalks or whatever those things are called, that you're going to drop a few things. And Jewish law held out for folks that whatever was dropped, then those who were poor and could not provide for themselves, if they came in behind you, that was theirs. So if you were a poor person who couldn't provide for yourself, you would come along after those folks that were doing the chopping, and you would kind of pick it up, and you would have that provision for yourself. However, once it was bundled up in sheaves, then you really couldn't grab that because that belonged back to the landowner. And so then do you understand what Ruth was doing? She was asking, not only, she didn't have to ask for kind of the leftovers that fell out of the hand of the harvesters, because that was, anybody could do that. What she was saying is, let me walk behind those who are tying the stuff up in sheaves. Can I get in that? Why was she asking for that? Because she recognized she probably could accumulate enough of the stuff for herself, but remember her commitment to her mother-in-law? It wasn't about what Ruth needed. It was about what Ruth and Naomi needed. And so she was saying, hey, to the overseer at the time, hey, let me walk in behind the folks who are tying the things in sheaves, because she recognizes that it's in the sheaves that she could provide for her and her family. She has taken on the role of Naomi's son in some way. She has become provider. And in this request, what she's done is, as a woman in this day and age, she stepped out of what is rightfully hers to do, to walk behind those who are harvesting, to say, there has to be more if I'm going to provide for me and my mother-in-law. The other thing that I think she wants to do that we have to recognize here is, do you remember, as it relates to Levirate law, not just Levirate law, but just the law in general, is if you don't take care, if your immediate family dies, responsibility for taking care of the family goes to kind of the next of kin. So we know that Naomi's husband dies, then her sons die, but when she goes back to Bethlehem, she certainly has some other kin that are there. We don't hear about them until we get introduced until Boaz is introduced in the story. And I think the question, at least that comes up for me, that Ruth is bringing to the forefront is, hey, hold on, next of kin, wealthy landowner, someone who has means, why haven't you provided for us? That's your responsibility. Remember, when Boaz rides into the fields, he's like, who is that woman? I've never seen her before. Why is this the first time that he has met Ruth? Why hasn't he made it a point to go interact with Ruth and or Naomi once he heard that they came back? And I think what Ruth is doing, not only is she trying to find a way to provide for her family by walking among the sheaves, she's also saying to Boaz, hey, Mr. Man on the Horse, this is your next of kin. Don't you have a responsibility to us? Not just to let us come back behind your workers who are harvesting and tying things up in bundles and sheaving, but isn't there a responsibility that you have to your family beyond this? Now, obviously I'm doing interpreting here because she says it much more kindly than that. She kind of takes on the role that you would imagine of someone in that day, and she's like, oh, sir, you look really kindly on me. How have I found favor of you? But it's also, hey, don't you have a responsibility here? And I think part of what Ruth is doing is reminding Boaz that he has to take care of those around him. And I think the reminder to us is that chesed relationship, that sense of loving kindness, it's not just commitment as it relates to verbal affirmation. That's strong and that's powerful. What she says to Ruth in chapter 1, amazing. But it's also a call to action. It's saying that there needs to be some movement that comes out of that. She doesn't just rest on her laurels and say, oh, I'm committed to you. But she, when they get to Bethlehem, she says, I'm so committed to you that I'm going to provide for you. And then what we get from Boaz is the recognition. It's like, whoa. And as in perhaps the only way he knows how, he recognizes that she has demonstrated loving kindness in a way that teaches him. Ben, can we put that verse up again? Let's go back. I should tell you what verse it is. I'm sorry, Ben. It's verse 11 and 12. I'll read it. I have it right here. I've been told all about what you have done for your mother-in-law since the death of your husband. How you left your father and mother and your homeland and came to live with a people you did not know. Normally, that might be just kind of this passing thing, but what Boaz is doing there is he is invoking the name and the story, not the name, but the story of the patriarch of the Israelites, Abraham. When God calls Abraham to leave his father and his mother, and I think Boaz is so moved by what Ruth is doing, he was like, oh, I've heard your story. And I think implicit in that is he's saying, and you've challenged me to a different reality. What you've done, leaving your father and mother and providing for your mother-in-law, I've heard it. And you know what? I've been remiss. He goes on to say, how you left your father and mother in your homeland and came to live without a people you did not know before you. May the Lord repay you for what you have done. This commitment that you have made, may the Lord now give back to you. And I think implicit in that, well, yeah, I'm going to let you kind of walk behind these guys and you can have as much as my field as you want. May the Lord repay you for what you have done. May you be richly rewarded by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge. So the reality is we have this situation in which Ruth, this stranger from a different land, brought into this family, has every right to go back to her home and her family to do what she needs to do so that she can secure a future for herself. She says, number one, beyond what I can know, I am committed to you, my mother-in-law. If you go to your homeland, I will go with you. That commitment of loving kindness, I will go where you go. But then the second part of it is that chesed relationship, it's not just about the wonderful things that we say. There has to be movement and action. There has to be some kind of beyond the verbal commitment. There has to be a commitment of action that says, I'm going to do this because I'm committed to you. And she takes on the unknown. She's willing to work. She's willing to walk along the fields. She's willing to challenge the landowner whom she has no right to challenge and say, listen up. There needs to be a different reality here. Ruth demonstrates for us that our connection and commitment to community has two dimensions. The first dimension is this faithfulness, this loving kindness. The second dimension is this action, this movement out of ourselves to do something significant, even when it risks who we are and what we're trying to do. What an amazing legacy. And it's that commitment in both dimensions that then secures the lineage that we find in our Savior. Even more amazing.